Is it riskier to work full time when you're unhappy and just not feeling fulfilled, or negotiate different working conditions based off of what you want? When you graduate with a lot of student loan debt, unless you have some sort of shocking trust fund or tons of savings or random equity in a business or something, in which case you probably wouldn't have student loans, you probably have a negative net worth, and it's probably a large negative net worth. The thing that I wanted to talk about in today's episode is why your net worth can be way higher than you think it can be. And we're going to show you how in this episode. Obviously, we've got a new year right around the corner, literally tomorrow when this comes out on the 31st of December. This is a time where everybody likes to focus on their New Year's resolutions, right? I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to go to this class that I've wanted to go to. I'm going to lose weight. All these different things that we always do for the beginning of the year, right? But I would suggest that you make your net worth and your financial health just as critical of a focus as your physical and spiritual and emotional health during this time. And I'll kind of show you why in some cases it's a lot easier to fix the financial health part of things than some of these other things. So that's good. It means less effort gets you immediate results. Imagine if you could do like 20 crunches every day and have a six pack. I mean, this is kind of the equivalent for some of the stuff we're going to talk about in today's episode with your finances. Everyone focuses on your negative net worth, right? But that's not the right way to look at it. Your negative net worth, if you're a student loan borrower, is really at worst a tax. Remember in the previous episode, I talked about this a little bit. That worst case scenario, if you have federal loans, you're paying 10% of your income to your loans, most likely. And then you're probably also paying somewhere between 2 to 10% towards your tax bomb amount every month. So worst case scenario, you're talking about a 20% tax. Now, let me be real, obviously, if Congress passed a 20% tax on middle income Americans, there'd be riots in the streets. So I'm not going to pretend that 20% isn't a lot, but hopefully you're earning a lot more money with your educational decision net of that 20% than you would have earned otherwise. Today, we're really going to talk about a couple things. We're going to talk about why your negative net worth is not actually the problem. And we're going to talk about ways to grow your assets to fix that negative net worth, to change your mindset, to show you why that negative net worth is not the problem. So for investments, we're going to talk about retirement, non-retirement accounts. We're going to talk about rentals, starting your own business, learning new skills. And we're going to talk about just a bunch of different things about how you might be able to grow that net worth. So first off, I want to talk about an example. This could be somebody with $150,000 of income and $400,000 of debt. So this could really be a lot of different professions. This could be a family physician. This could be maybe a high-earning pharmacist. This might be a dentist. So let's say one of those kind of professions with $150,000 of income and $400,000 of debt. We'll assume that this person is paying 10% of their income for 20 years. And with a $400,000 amount of debt, that they'd probably have a $250,000 tax bomb, $250,000 in their tax bomb that they're going to get hit with. But that only works out to about $650 a month for the tax bomb, about $1,000 a month for the loans. So you put those two together, you're looking at about $20,000 per year lost to paying loans and your tax bomb. And that works out to about 13% of your income. So it's actually even lower if you put money into retirement, because if you put money into your retirement, that lowers your taxable income, and that's going to allow you to pay less on your loans. So that might mean 11 or 12% instead of 13% of your income if you max your retirement savings in terms of what percentage of your income gets lost to the loans. So let's say that you do the pay-as-you-earn, right? A lot of you are familiar with that plan. You pay for 20 years. You need $100,000 to live on to be financially free. Let's assume that. So if you are saving 15% total, then basically 13% is getting eaten up, and then a smaller percent is available for retirement investing. So you really, in this case, we're assuming you're not really putting a lot away. We're assuming you're putting about $10,000 a year towards your investments. So really, this would be similar to somebody who's just putting, you know, 4 or 5% into retirement with an employer match, and that's it. And so let's assume that the $100,000 would be enough for you to live on. If you did put that $10,000 a year away, then you're looking at having to work for about 40 years. Obviously, that's a long time, but that's just telling you that you putting aside money for your match to get your match in retirement is not good enough. Now, if you had no loans at all, and if you took all that money that was going into loans and you put it into investments instead, then you would build up your net worth faster. You would have a working career about 10 years shorter. It'd be about 30 years instead of 40 years. But in reality, that's assuming that you put all that money that would have gone into loans into growing your net worth. If you just spent it, then you'd be in the same exact situation as somebody with a bunch of debt, right? What if you focused instead on growing your net worth? What if you focused instead of on your assets and said, okay, instead of having a huge debt problem where I'm going to earn a lot less money living on very little, trying to pay this debt back as fast as I can, what if you decided, okay, I'm going to become a practice owner, right? Or I'm going to buy a bunch of rental properties, or I'm going to do things to grow my income, like maybe pick up an extra day or extra shift or something every month. Then your required working career is about 30 years as well. Say if you earned an extra $100,000 and you kept your level of savings the same, you know, you didn't really increase your savings rate, then that would be similar to cutting your loans all the way down to zero. That's just one example, but let's talk about just a higher savings rate instead of higher income. Let's talk about $150,000 of income again. If you are looking to work less, the easiest way to do that is simply to save more. So if you have $150,000 of income, instead of buying brand new cars or living in a house that's three times your income, instead of doing that, let's assume that you've carved out a little bit of extra money that you could put aside into your assets. So instead of $10,000 a year, we're going to assume you're doing $30,000 a year towards your investments. So what would that look like in practice? So that would mean having a 401k and contributing the maximum. If you don't have a 401k at work, sometimes you can set your own up. It's called the solo 401k. If you're paid as an independent contractor with a 1099, you can set this up with a company like Schwab, for example, or Vanguard, and you can put more than the $19,000 limit into that. You can also set up a self-employed person's IRA. It's called an SEP IRA. And if you're employed, then hopefully you have access to a 401k at your work. If you don't, that's probably an indication of a low quality employer, and you would want to ask for one to get one at some point if you plan to stay there. But, you know, let's assume that you're putting the max into your retirement. So that's about $1,500 a month. You get write-offs for that. So that kind of only hits you at about $1,000 a month after taxes. And then also we'll assume you're putting aside around $1,000 a month into mutual funds like VTSAX at Vanguard or Betterment, or whatever account that you choose. That's really doable. To hit that $30,000 level of assets to lose $2,000 a month of after-tax income, I mean, you could spend that on upgrading your place to living in a penthouse, right? You know, in terms of in the city, you can rent a one bedroom for probably $900 a month. It's not that nice. So you can spend $2,900 a month and live in a luxury apartment complex. Or you can live with a roommate and live in a really decent apartment and spend about the same $900 a month. So if you think about that, then you could have a working career instead of 30 years. If you had no loans at all, your working career would actually be 3 years less than that. So it'd be 27 years instead of 30 with no debt at all. And that's assuming you're still putting, you know, a lot of payments into your loans and you're still doing pay as you earn, you're still saving for the tax bomb, all those things. So in this scenario, basically what we said is the problem was not that the person had the debt. The problem was that the person was not growing their assets. And that's the most common problem with student loan borrowers that I see, and so many people are guilty of it. If you buy your own practice, you have so many more write-offs available and you grow your income. You have greater capacity to shield that income from taxes. You can reduce the amount of income that the loan servicers see when they're taking 10% into account of your income. There's all kinds of ways that you can grow your assets, and I want to review a couple of them here. The first is just straight up investing. So when you're investing, you're putting money into different kinds of accounts. So usually you're investing probably in funds. So most people don't invest directly in individual stocks, and there's reasons for this. Most of your medical or lawyer types or professionals that you talk to that invest in individual stocks do not do it like my granddad did it, for example. My granddad would get copies of the American Individual Investor magazine. He'd constantly read Barron's. He'd would buy a stock and hold it for 15, 20 years. And most doctors want hot water cooler talk, to be frank. So most doctor portfolios, you'll see them heavily invested in, you know, social media companies or Tesla or, you know, whatever the hot thing is. Usually physicians find it after it's already been hot, and professionals in general. it's very difficult to outperform and get a great return when you're investing in individual stocks as a non-professional investor. So most people will use mutual funds and ETFs and things like that because they're more diversified and they make it easier to actually get your money to go to work. Now, here's the problem with those funds. You typically will put the money in and you will not really understand what you're doing, a lot of people, right? So you listen to somebody who tells you what a good fund is. Could be a financial advisor, could be a broker, it could be your brother-in-law, whatever. But a lot of times you'll invest in a mutual fund or an investment without really understanding what the fees are. Maybe best case scenario, you might be losing 1% of your money every year to an unnecessary fee, and that's reducing your long-term return. So in terms of investing, here's some important takeaways. You really want to go for two kinds of accounts. You want a retirement account that you're constantly contributing to, and you want a non-retirement account that you're constantly contributing to. If you can barely afford to survive, basically, if you're not doing well financially, I always suggest to folks that you have both of these accounts still being contributed to automatically. So for example, 5% is the minimum that you really want to be putting into retirement, and then 100 a month is the minimum you want to be putting into your non-retirement account. And these are automatic contributions that you want to be setting up. And we go into more details in our online courses as to how to do this. But the reason for that is, think about this. If you're in the car, you want to listen to your favorite radio station. If you don't know where the dial is and you don't know where the volume button is to increase the volume, if you don't have one of those, you know, controls on your steering wheel or something, then it's pretty difficult to listen to that station. So that's kind of the analogy that I would use for your investments, is if you don't get into the habit of setting up the accounts and you're not consistently contributing to those accounts with effort, just to make sure that you build up that habit of always contributing, right? Then that's going to significantly reduce your long-term net worth because of behavioral finance, because we know that habits that are generated are sticky habits that last, and it's a lot easier to increase your contribution from 100 a month automatic to 500 a month automatic than it is to go from 0 to 100. It's a lot harder for whatever reason. We're just creatures of inertia. So get your retirement and non-retirement accounts set up. I would suggest that most people need to attempt to maximize their retirement accounts. That means $19,000 a year, and then probably at least $1,000 a month into your non-retirement account. If you do those things, you'll at least be in a pretty good situation. Now, there's other ways to grow your assets besides just investments in publicly traded stocks and bonds. There's also rental properties. So one of my friends, Chad Carson, that we have an interview with for the course that we're doing this year, he goes into this idea of the rental debt snowball, which I think is really attractive. Basically, what you do is you buy a bunch of rental properties based off of what income you think you need to stop working. So for example, let's say that you need $100,000 to stop working and you find 10 units that rent for $10,000 a year, then that means eventually when those units are paid off, you'll have $100,000 of income, right? Now, technically, you might need a little bit more than that because of maintenance and taxes and things like that, but this is just a simplified example. So what you hope is you find properties that rent for more than the mortgage costs, and then you take that free cash flow every month and you throw it onto one of those mortgages and you pay down that mortgage, and let's say that it takes you 5 years. Well, now you have 9 mortgages instead of 10, and you have additional cash flow available for uses besides paying down that first mortgage. Now you can use it for those other mortgages. So now you target the 9 mortgages and only one of the 9, and then you pay that down and maybe it takes you 4.5 years, right? And then each successive house that you pay down, it's faster and faster. So it becomes an exponential payoff. That's the idea behind that rental debt snowball. And the end result is you have 10 units of paid off rental properties that can produce significant income and allow you to comfortably stop working at some point. So that's one strategy. We also, in our course, talk about this idea of becoming a professional real estate investor. So this is actually a trick that I was not aware of, because I'm not an expert in all forms of finance, right? It's too much to know. I've just talked to some of these friends that I met at our annual personal finance blogger conference, which is a huge meetup of everybody that's involved in the online personal finance community. This strategy was really interesting. Basically, you become a professional real estate investor, either because you're a little disillusioned with your job and you want to have that be your primary activity, or you have your spouse become a professional real estate investor and spend the majority of their time doing real estate work with a minimum of 750 hours required. And if you do that, then when you buy properties, you can write off a lot of the paper losses against your clinical income. So let's say that you're making $300,000 as a physician and you buy several properties a year, you fix them up, you take depreciation, which is just basically you write off a percentage of the value of the building, you write off some of the values of the appliances in the place, then that can write off your active income if you are a professional. If you're a professional real estate investor status, if you're not, then you can only write off passive income, which is not as good. But you know, they've used this strategy to pay 0% in taxes for the past several years. So that's really fascinating to me. There's that pathway. You also can do different kinds of strategies with rentals of just trying to build a large empire of real estate if you really want to. There's also the obvious path too of just owning your real estate for your own practice to generate additional write-offs and additional long-term wealth for that too. There's different ways that you can use real estate if you're more into that instead of investing, but it's just all of these different categories are optional categories. You don't have to participate in all of them. I would say probably only the investing category would be one that you would really need to try to contribute to. But one of the best, besides investing in rentals and things like that, is to start your own business, right? So think about this. So many of our folks that we talk to are afraid of owning their own business. But when you're doing a professional services business, this is a business category that has exceptionally low risk. That's why corporate landlords, one of their favorite people to rent to ever is a doctor's office, chiropractor's office, law office, right? Those are super stable professions, and the failure rate is not nearly as high as some restaurant that's going to come in. I mean, like in St. Louis, there's like 5 barbecue restaurants, it feels like, within a mile of me. I don't know how they all stay in business. And a lot of them tend to close every now and then. So, you know, you think about the dynamics of a professional services business, it's very low risk, which means that if you're working for someone else, they're naturally making a profit off of your labor, which means that there's a very low risk of you going out and owning your own business. Well, the interesting thing about professional services businesses is it's not like founding Facebook. You can't sell it for $1 billion, right? But you can sell it for something. So let's say that you have a practice that does $600,000 or $700,000 of revenue a year. That practice might sell for $500,000 if you're a dental practice owner at some point. You buy the practice with a loan from a bank and you gradually pay that loan off. That loan got paid off because you're earning the profits of the business instead of just the value of your labor. The profits of the business pay off the loan, and then suddenly you own an asset that you could sell. So that can sometimes be forced wealth growth of like 20, 30, 40, 50K per year. And that's really substantial if you think about it. I mean, that's like shaving an additional 10 years off of your working career to have that level of increased savings going on. Another way of asset growth that a lot of people overlook is learning a new skill. This is what you did when you borrowed your student loan debt, after all. And if you think about it, whenever you borrow student loans, it's a positive return on your investment if the years of your lost wages for the years that you were in school, and then you take your income after taking off, worst case, the 20% off of your income for what your net income would be after paying all your loans and everything, and you figure out, was that worth it compared to the job I would have gotten? So for example, if you're going to, as a, let's say, a pharmacist, you know, $100,000 is your income after school, and you write off 20% of it from the loss of saving for your tax bomb and paying your loans on the income-based program, so you're at 80. So you were in the pharmacy school, let's say, for, you know, whatever, 4 years or something. So you're at a situation where 4 years of lost income with, so say that's 50K times four, it's 200,000. And then how long does it take to make up the 80K versus the 50K that you would be making if you didn't go to pharmacy school? Well, maybe 7 to 10 years. Okay, well, was that worth it? You know, maybe, maybe not. It kind of depends. But the goal is if you get a new skill, you hope it has a positive ROI. So an example of one that might have a very positive ROI is maybe taking an implant course, right? If you're a dentist, if you think that that's going to be a procedure you'll be able to do in your practice and make a lot more revenue, then that's a classic thing where it makes a lot of sense to spend $10,000 to make an extra however many tens of thousands a year. The stuff that you can buy online, other kind of courses that you can invest in, if that allows you to either retain more assets or grow your wealth faster or save more money or save money on taxes, like those are things that make sense to spend or hire out. But, you know, in terms of learning a new skill, you know, a lot of times learning a new skill is just a really valuable thing to do. We forget sometimes that that is an investment, and investments take time to pay off. And the problem is we're humans. We're not stock portfolios, right? So we get super stressed out because our investment didn't pay itself back immediately and we think we're failures. Well, no, it's just because, you know, that investment takes time to pay back. And then when you make an investment, there is obviously some risk. And so that's what happens when a profession really kind of falls apart, because that risk is coming home to roost, right? But usually that doesn't happen. You can adjust and mitigate those risks by looking at yourself in the mirror and asking, what can I do to make myself save more and invest better and make fewer financial mistakes? So here's a weird concept. If you put only 5% or so into your wealth because you're paying your student loans and you just aren't saving very well, then your problem is not your net worth, because your net worth is really a tax. So in fact, when you graduate, your net worth shouldn't read negative $300,000. Your net worth should read zero, because that worst case scenario, that negative $300,000 net worth is just that tax of your tax mom with the monthly payment under an income-driven plan. So that's, let's say, a 20% tax, like we said, worst case, probably. So that means your problem is not the fact that you have debt. Your problem is that you're only saving 5% into your retirement. Your problem is that you're staying in your job as an employee way longer than you should because you're afraid to take that next step. Your problem is that you're afraid to take a risk in your career or negotiate your salary, and you're not putting the money away for your future. You're spending it on cars and houses that you don't need, that are not worth working an additional 10 years just to have. Here's a weird concept. Because you have student loans, there's more risk of not taking risks. So in other words, if you've already put all this money into your education, it's way riskier to trust a corporation like a dental service organization, like a DSO or a hospital. It's way riskier to trust them to pay you fairly for 30 years versus going and becoming your own boss, where default rates are 3 in 1,000. And to make it not about money for a second, is it riskier to work full time when you're unhappy and just not feeling fulfilled, or ask your boss for a flexible working arrangement, be it in fewer hours or more location independent? Now, obviously, some professions you can't do that, but you can negotiate different working conditions based off of what you want, because right now the labor market is like the most intense it's been, certainly since I graduated from college a while ago. It's just silly to be so worried when you have such an amazing negotiating position as a professional with a skill that's needed. Even if it's in a really competitive area, it's still something that is valuable, and you should take advantage of that and make sure that you're not wasting that opportunity to take a risk that makes sense. Here's an example of small things that you can fix. So the typical investor in the first 20 years of my life earned a little over 3% investing, because the typical investor is terrible at investing. They make all kinds of mistakes. They put their money in the wrong funds. They sell when you're not supposed to. They listen to the wrong people that are not financial advisors. They're insurance salespeople masquerading as financial advisors, right? The typical benchmark stock portfolio did 8%. Like, in other words, your typical index fund did 8% over the same time. So that means that your typical investor did 5% worse than the market. So if you did that worse than the stock market, which is very common for people that don't know what they're doing, if you look at that example I did earlier where the person's on page earn making 150 grand, you know, doing 30K a year into their investments because they're maxing retirement and doing like 10K in their mutual funds, then if you have the typical investor return, you're talking having $900,000 after their loans are forgiven. And that sounds good until you realize that if they hadn't made those typical mistakes, they would have had $1.6 million. So in other words, a person that didn't make those typical investor mistakes would have had $700,000 more money, $900,000 if they had made those mistakes, and $1.6 million if they had not. So this is why I'm talking about your net worth as part of the problem, because really net worth problems happen for two reasons. One is you don't know how to save and you're not doing that the right way. You're not putting money into investments. You're not ever deciding to own rentals. You're not opening your own practice. You're never doing anything that grows your assets in terms of what you own. You're just sort of coasting through life, just not thinking about it. So that's one problem that causes you to not have very much net worth. In fact, like the example I ran where the person's putting 5% to their retirement and that's it, that person ended up with $200,000 of net worth at the end of the 20 years of doing their pay as you earn. I mean, you're not anywhere close to retirement if you're doing that, right? So that's savings rate is clearly one of the big problems. And the other big savings problem, or the other big net worth problem that I wanted to show you was that typical investor making all those horrible mistakes with their investments. So they don't know how to invest smart for tax reasons. They don't know about all the tax tricks and loopholes that are out there. They don't know what accounts to use. They don't know what funds to use. They make the wrong decisions when the economy goes the wrong way, and they listen to the wrong people. In other words, that loss of almost half of what your net worth could have been, that's a loss that you don't see, right? You don't see the money that you don't make because of mistakes. And that's a really big issue, because instead of having $200,000 in net worth, this person could have had 8 times as much money simply by putting an extra $20,000 away into their investments and by not making horrible mistakes with it. And so what does that 8 times higher wealth mean? It means the person's probably going to spend 15 years less in the office, unless they just love it so much that it's the only place they'd like to be. To get way more money like that, to get twice as much money from not making investment mistakes, you could work twice as many hours. You could work twice as hard, or you could spend a little bit of time learning about having to grow your wealth and taking a few very measured, very low risk actions in your life, which is what I would like to see so many people do in 2020. If you get down to it, your net worth needs to be in a situation where your goal is, how do I get my net worth to be a positive number? How do I get to be a millionaire in terms of my student loans? One way is by paying down your loans directly if you know that you need to refinance, right? And I talk about who needs to do that a lot, but if you know you need to refinance, you know, you pay down your loans, sure, your savings rate matters more than where you put the money in that situation. But if you know that you shouldn't refinance, the way you dominate your finances is you get to the point where your net worth is positive, because once you have, you know, 500,000 of assets and 500,000 of debt, well, now you're zero. Now you're at zero. And if you get that up to, say, 1.5 million and you have 500,000 of debt, well, now you're a millionaire. And if you're a millionaire, are you stressed out about your debt that you have a net amount of net worth of $1 million with? No, you're not stressed. It's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, you are wealthy. You have more that you own than you owe. Like if you had a house and you had 50% equity in your house, you had a $100,000 mortgage and your house was worth $200,000, that wouldn't stress you out because you could just sell it and get rid of the debt, right? If you needed to. The same thing is true for your personal finances. You need to have a positive net worth. And to do that, you have to know about what savings rate you need to do and where to open those accounts and how to structure things from a step-by-step basis so that you don't let inertia win and don't ever make the contributions and it just sits in your savings account and then it just gets spent because it's just sitting there. And either you or your spouse or whatever, you're going to look at that money and think, oh, that'd be great to spend on the fill in the blank, the baloney thing that shows up on your phone on your Google ads because it knows your habits and tricks you into buying another car, golf bag, outfit, vacation, whatever that you really could do without if it meant saving 10 years off of your working career. Besides savings rate, the other thing is avoiding bad decisions with your asset growth investments. Basically, bad business decisions is what I would sum this up to. So here's a couple of examples of bad business decisions. Opening a private practice in one of the most saturated areas of the country when you could open one somewhere else. It's probably better to open a private practice or buy one versus be an employee if you have to stay in that one area. But that's just an example of how you'll lock yourself into a rate of return on your investment that's probably way lower. If you're buying a huge portfolio of San Francisco real estate while you're employed at a tech company, that's an example too of something that probably could not work out in a really bad way, because you could lose your job and you could lose a lot of the value of your real estate at the same time. So you could go from very wealthy to very broke in a hurry. Also, trusting a financial advisor who does not write in writing that they're a fiduciary. That's somebody that can sell you, you know, an insurance product or a high commission mutual fund or something that's basically in their own best interest that will reduce your return long term because of higher fees. You could avoid these mistakes with having a framework for how to approach investments and asset growth, or you could work a lot harder. And I think it's a lot easier to spend a few hours trying to learn how to manage your finances better. So for this new year, the six-figure debt to six-figure net worth investing course comes out in a week. We've totally updated it. We've added a ton of bonus content on real estate and other kinds of updates on tax loopholes and tax loss harvesting. We've updated a lot of the spreadsheets for 2020 data and limits for account contributions and all kinds of things. If you want to avoid the risk of losing hundreds of thousands on your net worth or just realizing how to get to the point where work is optional way faster, maybe a decade faster than you would if you kept your head in the sand. This is something that you need to do. So put that on your list of New Year's resolutions. The six-figure debt to six-figure net worth investing course launches January 7 to 14, and then we close it down. You got to wait another 6 months to get access to it again if you haven't already signed up for it. So really hope that you decide to make that investment in this new year, and have a happy new year. I hope you're celebrating. I hope you have some fun plans, and just know that this is the year where you can go out and you can take some smart risks, and you can put yourself on the path to getting to a level where you do not have to work again unless you want to, way, way sooner than you ever thought possible. Thanks, folks, and I'll see you again in 2020.